Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Bristol Festival of Ideas. My name is George Miller, and at this May's festival, I was fortunate enough to get the chance to interview several of the guest speakers. My guest in this programme is political philosopher John Gray, who appeared at the festival on the 21st of May to talk about his latest book, The Immortalisation Commission, Science and the Strange Quest to Cheat Death, which focuses on two apparently very different situations, Edwardian England and post-revolutionary Russia. What they had in common was a desire among certain members of the elite to prove that even in the post-Darwinian age, human beings could live beyond death. Before we talked about the book, I began by asking John Gray about the part literary festivals played in his life as a writer.
I enjoy literary festivals not only because they promote the books that I write, but also because it is both enjoyable and refreshing and instructive to meet the range of readers and find out what interests them in my work, because clearly people don't come to the events I give on my books unless they have some interest in what I'm doing, and it's interesting to interact with them on that basis. And of course also as a kind of added perk to meet other writers and see how what they're thinking about. And there are people now I meet at various events fairly regularly, so that's extremely pleasant. I mean, I don't do all of them. There are too many literary festivals. There must now be dozens. But I do quite a few, and I enjoy them. I don't regard it as an extra chore. I regard it as a perk. I regard it as one of the pleasantest aspects of being an author, which effectively I am now.
With the Immortalisation Commission, have you begun to get some sense of what it is about that book that interests readers from festivals and appearances?
What interests readers of the Immortalisation Commission, as revealed in festivals and other book events that I've taken part in, is sometimes the stories involved. In other words, the human struggles, private struggles, which led late 19th century philosophers and politicians and writers to seek to make to attain contact with the dead. They're very interested in the fact that these leading figures could take this seriously enough to devote parts of their lives to it. And others are interested because they see it as part of a debate about religion and belief and about science. And as indeed it is, because one of the main themes of the book is that already by the end of the 19th century in England and then and in Russia, science was becoming a vessel for hopes and projects that had been hitherto part of religion or of occultism. And this mingling of science with faith and magic and the occult seems to be of great interest to a lot of people. So there is two sides, the narrative side, the stories with which most readers will be unfamiliar, and the other side being the themes that these stories illustrate in the lives of the people who are the protagonists.
It seems to me, just thinking about it again last night, that both projects, both the Edwardian English project to investigate life after death and the Bolshevik project to create it after death, kind of resulted from a sort of cognitive dissonance, that people in both those situations couldn't really cope with the fact that, on one hand, the Edwardians had their sort of 19th century Christianity and conservatism, and couldn't really reconcile that with what Darwinism was telling them. And then with the Bolsheviks, their sense of mastery, of having conquered, of having come out victors in the revolution, that sort of omnipotent thing, again, couldn't be reconciled easily with the finitude of life as they saw it. And so they were both sort of struggling to overcome that in this way.
The cognitive dissonance in both of these projects, the Edwardian project of showing that death did not in fact exist, and that the human mind went on after bodily death, and the Bolshevik project of conquering death by creating the possibility of continuing life or even of immortality after death. And they both resulted, as you say, from cognitive dissonance, from an inability to reconcile the beliefs of the two groups and the hopes of the two groups with what Darwin had revealed. I would say that in both cases, there was an underlying dissonance as well between the fact of death, which, if Darwin was right, meant final loss, the termination of individual development, and even in the long run, the extinction of the species. These ultimate facts of loss with a belief in progress. Because in their different ways, these Edwardian Christians or Edwardian agnostics who turn to scientific research, the Bolsheviks who scorned liberal ideas of progress but believed in progress and catastrophe, they did think that the human story was, or could be, one of continuing advance in which the gains of the past could be preserved and accumulated, and humanity would advance to a form of life better than anything that had ever existed before. And of course, the fact of death and of ultimate extinction and the Darwinian vision of the interaction of chance and necessity is hard to reconcile with this story of progress. So it was actually, I think, in both cases, a belief in progress which was challenged, which is why, in the Edwardian side, some of them believe they been able to show that progress continued on the other side, that there were scientists there expanding knowledge. And remember, for them, progress meant what it still means today, I think, which is ethical and political advance following upon the advance of knowledge. The idea that you could have the possibility of continuing advancing knowledge without ethical and political improvement was not one the other contemplated. And that was also true of the Bolsheviks, who thought that their view of the world was scientific and who proposed that, as did the scientific researchers, that insisted that it was scientific and thought that science could conquer death. So I think it was a belief in progress, or if you like, in an idea of redemption through history and in individual lives. And so for many of these thinkers, what was challenging about mortality in a Darwinian context is that nothing remained. Progress, development didn't go on. It was simply cut off, sometimes, very often, arbitrarily, by illness, accident, crime, or war. And that's what they couldn't. So I think you're quite right. It was, but it remains a cognitive dissonance, which is why in the last chapter of the Immortalization Commission, I discuss such things as Gary Kurzweil, who believes that those now living can, if they diet and a regime of preventive medicine that he sets out in his book Transcend, they can live long enough, he thinks, to benefit from something he calls the singularity, which is an explosive growth in human knowledge. Once again, it's knowledge which is growing in this scenario. And as a result of that, human beings will be able to upload their conscious minds into a virtual realm of deathless invulnerability, which has many things in common, although there's a different technology involved, with the posthumous world envisioned by the psych researchers of the 19th century. So these hopes and the cognitive dissonances from which they arise haven't stopped. They're continuing to occur in our culture now. There isn't scientific research, there isn't automatic writing. Well, there is scientific research, but it's shrunken, and automatic writing is no longer a central technique. But through the technologies that we now have, the internet, the cyberspace, virtual reality technologies, people are still pursuing the hope of immortality for the reasons you mentioned.
And again, looking at the things the two projects had in common, it seemed to me they were both very much the preserval of elites with a concomitant, often quite explicit contempt for the broad mass of humanity. H.G. Wells, who is a sort of pivotal figure in your story, refers to superfluous people, and Maxim Gorky refers to, I think, human units or something along those lines. So there's a distinct sense of the elite having to lead the way and forge the bridge to the new, and the rest of humanity being left behind.
Well, it's not often remembered that or understood that eugenic theories had a tremendously large constituency among scientists and political thinkers, including those who regarded themselves as highly progressive in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And this extended even to psychical research and spiritualism. I mean, one of the features of these movements, psychical research, a kind of an elite intellectual inquiry and spiritualism, something more like a popular religion, was that the bodies that humans would have in the afterlife, because they would have some kind of body, so weren't exactly specified what they were, astral or etheric bodies, would be improved versions, enhanced versions of the ones they had in life. And for some people involved in these movements, there was the idea that imperfections which exist in the world that we know could be eliminated in the afterlife. And one of the central and most incredible narratives of stories in the Immortalization Commission is about a project which some psychic researchers believed they were participating in which Posthumous scientists had designed by a kind of eugenics a messiah figure who would be born as a human being. In other words, this was a messianic project but conceived in the framework of eugenic science. And of course, eugenic science, eugenic theories at this time, always have the tendency to write off sections of the human species as being superfluous as well as corny or as being subhuman, as Gorky put it in respect of peasants and others. So there is this aspect, even though in the case of the Edwardian project, there was spiritualism as a popular religion as well as secular research as an elite pursuit. And there was some popular support, but never very much, for Bolsheviks in Russia. It was an idea of the improvement of the human species, not only in terms of its living conditions, but in terms of its very character as a species. In other words, the whole species had to be lifted up, and if in that struggle, existing human beings with their imperfections and frailties were either obstacles or unnecessary, they could in one way or another be eliminated, at the very least left behind, or even as Wells contemplated in some of his non-fiction work, so to speak, encouraged to disappear. I mean, like many others at that time, Wells did have a streak of very unpleasant racism in his thinking and didn't shrink from saying that cultures and civilizations and peoples and communities that were deficient, as he put it, must simply disappear and perhaps along with the people who made them up. So there was this aspect to it which is, I think, unpleasant, but because there's another aspect of it, certainly in the Edwardian case, where it represents, I think, a kind of humanly moving and poignant attempt, the attempt to show a continuity between bodily life and life in an imagined afterworld, where it arises from either unfulfillment in this, the life that people have lived, or in the loss of people to whom they've been deeply attached or whom they love. Because in most cases, actually, among the Edwardians, it wasn't they themselves that they were looking to show would survive. In most cases, what they had been led into the inquiry into by was an experience of bereavement. And we tend to forget that in late Victorian England and Edwardian England, the human response to bereavement was just as traumatic as it is now, but the bereavement was more common. Infants often died not long after being born, and there were still infectious diseases. People who travelled abroad often perished, and so on. So it was very common, or even a very common experience, but no less difficult to handle, no less difficult to cope with. And with the retreat of religion and the power of consolation that religion may once have had diminished, and sections of the educated middle classes as well as of the elite turn to projects they imagined were scientific, I think, to fend off this experience of unbearable loss. And that, of course, is humanly, I think, quite moving even now.
Yeah, before I read your book, I had been under the impression that it was the First World War that had really catalyzed this spike in spiritualism, but in fact, there was quite a late Victorian malaise that was, as you described, that was sort of feeding this yearning, it's a sort of unfulfilled yearning, isn't it?
Well, it goes back, I mean, spiritualism is a popular movement, goes back to the early 19th century, but psychical research as a sort of an elite intellectual activity is the last, something gets going in the last couple of two or three decades of the 19th century, particularly among Cambridge academics, philosophers, classicists, So it was triggered, you're quite right, that it was enhanced by the First War, though not very interesting by the Second, which killed off whatever remained of it. I think partly because, although the First World War was a terrible catastrophe in terms of the loss of life and the loss of continent and civilization that it entailed, the true horrors of the Second World War, such as the Holocaust, were so almost unimaginable, the Holocaust of the war, that really these ideas of a posthumous world in which we really became very questionable. So, but I think the emergence of spiritualism and later of psycho research in the 19th century shows the depth and subtlety of the challenges to which these movements were responding, and in particular, the way in which science inherited hopes and functions that religion could no longer maintain. And that's really one of the themes, several themes of the book, which is that I think we still turn to science for things that science can't provide. Science can't provide meaning, it can't protect us ultimately from mortality, even if it can indefinitely extend life. It'll still be not only accidents, but wars and crimes and social upheavals which would threaten our lives even if science manages to defeat the aging. And science can't really provide the narrative of meaningful advance that people are still looking for.
I was talking to John Gray. That's all for this podcast, but there's plenty more to explore on the festival website at ideasfestival.co.uk, including an audio archive of interviews and, of course, news of forthcoming festival events. Do join me again soon for another Festival Ideas podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.